Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm Anne-Marie Ruff. I'm here with author Kim Fay, author of The Map of Lost Memories. And Kim, welcome.
Hi, Anne-Marie. And I'll let people know that I'm here with Anne-Marie Ruff, who is the author of Through These Veins. It's great to talk to you today, Anne-Marie.
Thank you. And as we were talking earlier, we realized that we have kind of a parallel background, parallel interests in what we're writing about. So, Kim, why don't you just give us a quick intro about what your book is about?
Okay, great. The Map of Lost Memories is an historical novel that takes place in 1925 in Shanghai, Saigon, and the Cambodian jungle. It is the story of a young American woman who takes off from Seattle, and she goes, she's in search of what she believes to be is a lost Khmer relic. The Khmer are the ancient Cambodians, and she is looking for this relic because it's believed to contain the lost history of the Cambodian people, which at that time period was not known. So it's a bit of an adventure novel, but it's also a novel about how the characters develop their views about taking from another culture as they travel throughout these countries. Anne-Marie, how about your book?
Well, Through These Veins is set partly in Ethiopia and partly in the United States. And the setup is that an Italian plant scientist, a researcher, is on a field expedition in Ethiopia and discovers in a highland village a local medicine man who appears to be curing people of AIDS with local plant-based medicines. And he takes samples of those plants and sends them to colleagues at the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C., who discover that there's some really viable antiretroviral properties in these plants, and then proceed to develop a pharmaceutical drug out of them. So corporate intrigue and sex and murder ensues. And
that's the corporate intrigue. But not a murder, at least.
Right. All good stories, right?
Exactly. No, I think it was interesting. We've just discovered that we both have a really strong interest in sense of place in fiction. And I'd love to hear more about how that influenced your writing of Through These Veins.
Well, like you, I was living in Southeast Asia for a while, although you were in Vietnam and I was in Thailand. And I actually followed a love interest to the Middle East. So I was not actually living in Ethiopia, but I traveled to Ethiopia to do research for this book because I wanted it to be set in an African country, and I wanted a historical character to figure into it. And the only place that this historical character had been in Africa was in Ethiopia. So I traveled there. So I actually was writing about a place that I didn't know very well. So in the 3 weeks that I was there, I was just consuming as much as I could of sort of the ambience. But you were writing in a place about a place that you lived and had grown to love and felt very familiar with. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as you mentioned, I lived in Vietnam for 4 years when I was in my 20s. But my love of Asia came when I was a child. My grandfather was a sailor. He was in the Navy, and he sailed in the South China Sea in the 1930s. So Asia was kind of set in my mind when I was very young as this exotic place, as this not only a faraway place but a familiar place because it was the place of my grandfather's youth. So when I moved to Vietnam to teach English, I discovered a very strange feeling of familiarity when I moved there, and I fell madly in love with the country. And it was there that I started writing about Asia. I had written some fiction before, but it was all very domestic. And when I got there, I read a book called Silk Roads, which was the true story of André and Clara Malraux, a young French couple who stole a bas-relief from the Cambodian temples in the 1920s. And this just sparked my novel. And my novel started moving. And as I started working on the novel, I realized I really wanted to share this part of the world that I loved so much with other people. I knew, everybody I knew at home, most of them would never travel to this part of the world, and I wanted to be able to give them kind of the essence of it, the feeling of being there, that true sense of place. And that was a really, even though I was writing an adventure novel and a suspense novel and all of that, there was this motivation to immerse my reader in this part of the world.
And I have to say, in even just opening up the first chapter of your book and reading, although it's in Shanghai, not in Southeast Asia, but the smells, the sound of the river washing up against the embankment, the awnings, the smell of rotting and jasmine, and I thought, oh, I'm right there back in Bangkok living next to the Klang, like next to the canal. So I don't really
know why that is so romantic, the smell of rotting and jasmine, but it is. It really is.
Yeah. Because I think it's so, well, it's very exotic. It's so different from sort of our sturdy, mainstream American upbringing for those of us who grew up in such a way. And I think, certainly in American popular culture, Vietnam has become the setting of war and conflict and sort of all things bad. So how do you convey a place that is so different from our media stereotypes of Vietnam?
I think for me it worked because, as I've mentioned to you before, the country became so familiar to me. So when I was writing about it, after a certain point of time, I wasn't writing about it as an exotic place. I was writing about it as a place where I felt so at home. So I think that sense of belonging comes through. I'm not, there became a point when I was no longer an outsider. When all of my friends there were Vietnamese, when I was participating in, there's a family that actually called me daughter number four. When I got married this year, the mother gave me the traditional wedding quilt that takes a year to make that she'd given her other three daughters.
Wow.
And so I was writing about a country from a place of home and a place where I felt at home. And I think that is how I could bring through, the beauty of the country, but also separate myself from certain historical aspects that have taken over, as you said, in American pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're both writing about places that are stuck in certain ways in the American mindset. Mm-hmm. You said that you specifically wanted your book set in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And could you talk a little more about the reason that was so important as far as, I think, a lot of the, character motivation and responses, from the outside to the value of the country.
Well, the spark for this novel, you said your spark came from reading about temple thieves. And the spark for this came for me when I was covering a science conference in Malaysia. And I met this Italian scientist who was extremely charismatic and told these stories of collecting agricultural plants and seeds like they were Indiana Jones style stories.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of the holy instead of the great golden artifact, he was looking for broad beans and fava beans, and I thought, this guy is incredible, and he told stories of elephants and lions and pygmies, and I thought, he had collected in maybe a dozen African countries, although not in Ethiopia. And so I really wanted it to be set in an African country because, one, it's so exotic for most of us. Two, I had never been there. And I thought, three, to be kind of accurate to his basic story, I wanted it set on the African continent. And so the only African country where this historical character had been was in Ethiopia. So I planned a trip. And when I told some family friends at home that I was planning to go, and a friend said to me, "Well, I'm sure you'll be very generous with all the starving people there in the deserts." And I was amazed that these images of the 1980s and famine in Ethiopia were people's only touchstone for what this country was like. And when I got there, I was astounded at what an incredibly green country it was. There are deserts in the east near Somalia, but I was in the western and northern part, and it was it, you know, the whole country was like covered in green velvet. It was just so verdant. And there were rivers and horses and meadows.
That's something you do not expect at all when you think of your, you know, what you've seen on the news, what you've seen.
Certainly.
What you've read about.
And I found that Ethiopian people were incredibly cultured in ways that I hadn't expected. You know, they have this rich history of Christianity, Orthodox Christianity. The bones of Lucy, the first hominid, are in the Addis Ababa Museum. And many people, even out in the villages, spoke English to me, which was surprising. So
that's really interesting.
So it was really different than I expected. I was glad to sort of convey some of that.
Okay. What you're talking about right now kind of leads into something else that I think is of interest to both of us. And it also has to do with the reason we chose specific, we chose specific places for all the reasons we've talked about. But also, I feel that perhaps you had to choose a country like Ethiopia because there are certain countries in the world where if you take something from that country, and this sounds, this might come across the wrong way, but you know, people don't care. You know, there are certain places like in Indochina in the 1920s, if you took from them, nobody cared. You know, you couldn't go into England and take something at that time, but you could go into these developing countries all over Asia and just plunder them. And there was no recourse.
Right. And you,
and
yours goes right to the heart of that. Yours goes right to the heart of that, of actually stealing art. And talk about how your characters can think that, that's right, or that their culture justifies that.
It's interesting because, you know, I've been asked why 1925, and clearly, you know, the era appeals to me, and there are all sorts of aspects, you know, that are very, very appealing about that and my grandfather's time. But it was also, as far as art was concerned, a very unique time for thieves, shall we say, for collecting. How's that? You know, in the late 19th century, there was the advent of mass tourism, and also art dealing was being developed more as a profession. You had the robber barons, you had the industrialists, you had a lot of money, and you didn't have any real laws. Scholarship was in its infancy. There wasn't a lot of documentation before World War II of provenances, you know, recording where things had come from, where they were going, how they had come to be. And so there was a bit of a free-for-all at that time. And then, you know, you had World War II. You had down-and-out aristocrats selling off their art. You had speculators who'd made all this money turning their talents now to the art world. And so it was such a morally ambiguous time when it came to art for many people. Clearly not for everyone. You know, there were all people who, you know, had very, you know, strong values. But there were a lot of people who were just out there thinking, like my main character, she loses her job at a museum, and a job she thought, I'll step back for a second. In the beginning of the book, you learn that she was up for a curatorship that she lost to a man. And in order, she feels, to rebuild the reputation that she has lost, she's going to go find this piece of art. These lost scrolls. And so she embarks on this journey to find them. And a lot of her journey, she's thinking, this is mine, this is my right, I deserve this, I've worked hard. But there's also a part of her that's thinking, well, the Cambodians don't deserve it. Look what's happened to their temples. Look what they've done. They haven't taken care of anything. They need people like me to take care of it. And so there was that mindset, too, because people, you know, especially, you know, Europeans and Westerners, they would go to that part of the world, and their mindset was that, well, these people are uncivilized. They can't be responsible for their own culture. And so they would just take. You know, they would just take what they wanted. And certainly, you know, the colonizing countries, you know, France was moving everything back to museums in their own country. Or the French were moving everything back to museums in France. You know, the British were moving museums in the UK, America. You know, everybody was doing that. So it was just fascinating. There's so much accountability now. I mean, we know these things still happen, but it's harder to get away with.
Although it still happens very currently. When I was living in Abu Dhabi during the second invasion of Iraq, All kinds of unusual things started showing up in antique shops in Abu Dhabi and Dubai. You know, ancient scrolls, you know, little scrolls in sort of clay, things that you would press into a clay tablet, and all kinds of things that had been pillaged from the museum in Baghdad were showing up further down the Gulf. So it's a very current issue, and the sense of moral ambiguity, is it better for those things to be outside of a country at war where other people can take care of them?
It's such a hard question because you look at, for example, the Angkor Wat temples now are still being pillaged. You know, the people will go in with hacksaws and remove features from bas reliefs, and every time I go back, more is missing.
Wow.
And you don't just go in and take something from, you know, you just don't walk into somebody's house and say, you're not taking care of this, so I'm going to take it home.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's art, people have stronger feelings about it, you know, much stronger than if somebody's just not taking care of their sofa. You know, that's a silly analogy, but it's people, you know, they just have these strong feelings about how other people are taking care of their own culture.
And you can really see how people could rationalize that by saying, well, you know, we're going to put it in a museum in X country where millions of people will be able to see it who would never otherwise be able to travel to that place.
This is very, very true. Very true. But, again, it's a question I can't, and I don't claim to answer it in my book. I'm not sure what answers, you know, how you feel in your book as well. I more just wanted to raise the question so that people could talk about them.
Well, I think that's right. I think moral ambiguity, however it presents itself, is incredibly complex. And most people, morality is kind of a movable feast, depending on your perspective and your
very
goals
much so.
And your culture and the norms of your religion and all of that. Mm-hmm. So most people do not do abhorrent things because they're bad, but because they have a different justification for them.
That's very interesting. I'd like to hear, because I feel that that's very much a part of my novel, and I'd love to hear more about that in yours, in Through These Veins, because you're talking about taking something that is very not so concrete. You know, and I would love to hear more about your character's justification for what they're doing.
Well, you know, so what you're talking about, mentioning in my novel, is that this Italian plant explorer takes samples of plants from Ethiopia and brings them to the United States, where they sort of feed into the pharmaceutical pipeline, and they could potentially be incredibly valuable. And so it's not only the plants themselves, but the knowledge of how they work together, which is very ephemeral. That kind of knowledge. And so who owns it? And this is very much a current topic in the world. Who owns genetic resources?
Yes, exactly.
Who owns intellectual property? Who owns, you know, how can you patent? What can you patent? Who can hold a patent? So my characters, the Italian scientist justifies it as, you know, he is bringing a potentially valuable resource to the wider world, where it could potentially be developed into a drug that could cure a lot of people of AIDS. And the issue is
which is a valid argument in and of itself.
Sure.
Definitely.
Sure. And so then there's another horrendous act that happens in the novel that I won't tell you about. But the person who commits that horrendous act justifies it as thinking about the good of the many over the good of the one. And so with that kind of ethical presumption, you can justify all kinds of horrid acts.
Well, and that's horrid acts, and also, I mean, it goes back to the art. You know, people are saying, well, we're preserving it for everybody. You know, not really thinking about the fact that, for example, in Cambodia, the Cambodians can't afford to go someplace
sure.
else to see their own art.
Sure.
But then again, the art's not disappearing. It's not vanishing or flat out being destroyed.
Right.
Which is unfortunately what happens with the temples, simply because they're made of sandstone. And when you take something from them, you're defacing them. You're not just moving something.
Right.
So
can you talk a little bit about how you your sort of obligation to the people in the places you write about? And we talked a little bit earlier about how you and I have had the privilege of traveling mm-hmm. to lots of places and experiencing different cultures and different places in a way that many people, both American and in the countries that we visited, will not or cannot do.
Mm-hmm. I think as far as obligations concerned, this is it's something I don't necessarily think about consciously all the time, but the thing I like about fiction and the thing I like about writing about a country that I love is that I get to share aspects of it that I feel people outside the country may not be aware of. I get to share layers that come from living there for many years, and I don't know that I see it as an obligation. I see it more as an honor.
Mm.
It's an honor for me to be able to develop characters and give them depth and then share them with the outside world, because I feel, you know, there's one character in my novel, a local woman, who plays a role toward the end of the book. And there are some things about her that are cliched because at that time, local women had very few roles in the, in the Western society that was living there. Mm-hmm. But I also try to infuse her with all of the qualities that I love best about my best friends over there, because those are there are a lot of shared qualities that I find in my Vietnamese friends, a very mm-hmm. openness, a warmness, mm-hmm. this genuine opening of the arms. And I wanted to convey these aspects that people who have just seen Vietnam on TV or seen these, you know, most people who've seen Cambodia, the only thing they know is the Khmer Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a country that sounds silly, but, of human beings. And I can only speak from my own experiences, and I can only write from my own personal experiences. But to have the honor to be able to share parts of the country that most people aren't aware of, you know, and not just the sense of place, but also the sense of people. That's one of the big motivations behind my next novel, is that I really want to share aspects of Vietnam that are just not well known outside the country.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that next novel?
I can. I would love to. It doesn't have a title yet, but it is the story of a young American woman who is born to American parents in Vietnam in the 1930s. Her parents are sociologists. And she's born and raised in Vietnam, and as she grows up, she becomes a culinary anthropologist. She studies imperial cuisine. She studies Vietnam has a very famous imperial cuisine. And she also cooks for homesick soldiers.
Hmm.
But her life is very domestic. It's a very domestic life, and this is what I learned when I lived there, is that many of my friends lived very domestic lives that were only touched on the periphery by the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to tell a story of a more domestic story. But as I mentioned to you, I read Nancy Drew all my life. I love a good murder, and I love suspense. So there will be a murder at the beginning of the book, and the murder is moves the book forward, but also pulls the people out of their domestic world and into the world that the public knows, you know, the world of the war. And I want to juxtapose the two so that people can see that this was a country of people at war, as well as two governments at war.
Right.
And as you and I talked, we discovered in both of our new novels, we have issues of loyalty. What else were we?
Identity.
You stated it so well. Exactly.
Loyalty, identity, revenge, justice.
Revenge, that was yes. Those four play up in both of our next novels. So why don't you guys? I love your description of your next novel. Can you tell us about it?
Sure, I'd love to. The working title is Beneath the Same Heaven, and the premise.
Ooh, I like that.
The premise is...
I promise I won't steal it.
You could call yours Beneath the Same Sky, and we would just be parallel again.
There you go.
It's about an American woman who marries a Pakistani man, a man who then commits a terrorist act. And the premise, the setup, is that the man's father in Pakistan attends a dear family friend's wedding in the frontier territories near the Afghan border. And he is killed in a drone attack, a U.S. attack of drones, because the U.S. government claims it's a gathering of the Taliban. So then the son, who has become an American citizen, is then obligated by culture to avenge this wrong to his family. So it's, you know, it's a very searing tale of how our different ideas about justice and who we are and who is our family can really wreak havoc on our lives and our countries. So, but this idea, I'm fascinated by this idea of people transplanted outside of their culture.
Okay, that's so funny, because as you were speaking, I just wrote myself a little note, and that's what I wrote. Because as I was listening to you talk, I was thinking that both you and I, have, in both of our novels, are writing about a person who has moved into a new culture, and what the acts that are taking place in the book, all of the experiences, are this person somehow coming up against that culture, whether in a good way or a bad way, but shedding light on the culture from an outside perspective, but also shedding light on the person, you know, through the lens of the culture.
Right.
Which is a really interesting, you know, as you were speaking, that was an interesting aspect of that.
Well, and I think it's such a current question. You know, you're writing about earlier periods of history, and I'm writing something more current. But human cultures have been rubbing up against each other since, you know, Genghis Khan rode across the prairies and massacred the Europeans, you know. But so globalization is not a new idea. And each time each massive wave of globalization tends to look a little bit different. You know, now it's characterized more by economic warfare and cultural exchange and intermarriage. But, you know, these humans have been putting themselves in different places forever. And the different ways we deal with it and how we view the relative value and power of our own culture as compared to where we end up is fascinating. And often a source of conflict.
And it's a never-ending story, I guess. It's one of those universals that continues to be a universal.
Well, I'm curious, when you were in Vietnam, you know, as an American, and certainly the Americans have a dubious history in Vietnam. And so how did people treat you as an American?
I'm asked this often, and, you know, I don't know if this is, was just my personal experience, but I've never had a bad experience in Vietnam. You know, I've had your typical, you go to the grocery store and have a bad day experience, but I've never, I've moved there, it was exactly 20 years after the end of the war, and I never experienced animosity because of that. When the war did come up, you know, it wasn't talked about all the time, but when it did come up, most people would say your government fought our government. Mm-hmm. It was not your people were not fighting our people. Your government was fighting our government. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, people go to war and they do what they need to do for their country. Mm-hmm. But I did not, you know, I was never, there was never, I never felt unsafe in Vietnam. I never felt uncomfortable in a room. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I was in rooms with my best girlfriend, Vietnamese girlfriend over there, her family lives out in the countryside, and, you know, she has uncles who are missing arms and legs and who are blind. She has family members. She's lost a lot of family members because of Agent Orange and the chemicals in the water. You know, a lot of family members died very young, various suspicious illnesses. And I just, to be warmly welcomed, for example, in a situation like that, I marveled again at the capacity for a country, A, to forgive, but B, also to put things in perspective, because I don't know how you can put something like that in perspective, because it just, everything I've read is so atrocious, but to make a very short answer long, I was just always treated so well over there, and I never had that. I never felt that the war was something that was hanging over my experience with anyone I had at all. So, as you're in a country, you're in a part of the world, or you were in a part of the world that it wasn't historical, the fighting that was going on. How was your experience with that as far as being welcomed and how you were treated?
Well, you know, I was in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates, during the second invasion of the Gulf of Iraq. And I remember being on the freeway between Dubai and Abu Dhabi and seeing just huge convoys of military vehicles driving past. And I wasn't sure if they were UAE vehicles or if they were U.S. or where, but it was very ominous. And, you know, UAE was sort of like the Switzerland of the Middle East, so I wasn't worried for my own safety. But in my apartment building, there was an Iraqi guy who had moved into the flat next door and was waiting for his wife and children to come. And I sort of tripped all over myself to go and see him and kind of express my sympathy and my, you know, shared concern for his family and my sort of apologies. And he was absolutely bewildered about what I was doing there. And I had another Iraqi friend who was a very dear friend that I worked with, and he kind of looked at me with, I don't know, it was almost condescending, but he was like, why do you think you would have any control over what your government does? You know, why would you think you're so powerful or that this has anything to do with you? He said, you know, I was a translator during Saddam's time, but I had nothing to do with what Saddam did. And
it's a very different perspective.
Yeah. And when my friend brought his mother from Baghdad, I was sitting with him one night for dinner, and George Bush came on the television on the news, and she threw a sock at him or something at the television, and she said, we hate George Bush, but we love you. And so I had that same experience that I was an individual person. I was not a representative of my government.
But at the same time, you and I have talked about the feeling of needing to be ambassadors in some way when we travel, which is an interesting aspect of that as well. You know, feeling that we need to, even though we're not representative of our government, how we act and behave will reflect on where we're from.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so you realize it's very important to be a good representative of what you would like others to think of American culture and American people. And as you mentioned earlier when we were talking offline, that for a lot of people in countries where we have visited, we are sort of an interesting outside experience that might not be very common to them. And so they will extrapolate about American people based on their experiences with individual travelers like you or like me.
That is so true. That's something that, you know, I don't know if all travelers realize that how limited certain experiences are by the people in other countries. And so when you are there, every move you make becomes much bigger once you're gone.
Did you find that you encountered misconceptions about American people or American culture that you had to dispel?
Well, you know, there's the usual. Americans are very loud. That was hard to dispel a lot of times as you're traveling. You know, I think I was actually in Laos on 9/11, and that was, I think, what my biggest eye opener as far as the world's experience or the world's opinion of my country. I definitely wasn't, you know, an ostrich with its head in the sand, but at the same time, I was very unprepared for the animosity that came, not from the Laotians. The Laotians were very kind, and as we moved into Vietnam, the Vietnamese were very concerned and very sympathetic. But the Westerners were pretty hard. My sister and a friend and I, we were the only three Americans in the small town of Lang Prabang when the attack took place, and it was being televised on a TV in a small cafe, and every a Westerner had gathered there to watch the event. And when we walked in, we first thought they were watching, you know, a movie. And then when we realized what was going on, we just kind of stood there. And as the group sitting there realized that we were Americans, one of them turned and looked at us, and he looked us up and down, and he said, "Well, what did you expect?"
Wow.
And I thought, you know, I don't want to go off on a political conversation now, because that's a completely different, you know, that's a whole, that's another conversation completely.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just one of those real eye-opening moments that I'm very well aware of world opinion, but to have it aimed directly at you and it was a lot of food for thought. And it was, I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, what I wanted to be as I traveled, and how I wanted to be, and what it meant, you know, what it meant not only for my quote-unquote country's reputation, but what it also meant for the people I encountered and for myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's all of these subjects are interesting. One leads to the other, to the other, to the other.
Yeah. Well, it's a big world, and it's fascinating, and when you mix it up and put people together, you get really interesting.
You have
stuff.
Lots of stuff to write about.
Well,
that's
Kim, I think we could talk till the cows come home ever more parallels between our lives and our writing.
Well,
and
this has been a real wonderful experience. I'm so excited to read your new book and to talk. We're going to be in conversation at the West Hollywood Book Fair. So
right.
We can talk even more about this on September 30th.
Tell us again your book and where we can get it.
Okay. My book is The Map of Lost Memories, and it came out on Tuesday. So this is a
congratulations.
Big week for me. Thank you. And it's all over LA at all the indie bookstores, the Barnes & Noble. You can also get it online, Amazon, all those good places. So.
And do you have a website?
I do. I do. It is www.kimfay.net. And how about you, Anne-Marie?
Yes. Great. My book is called Through These Veins. It's available on both Kindle and hard copy through the usual channels. And you can find me at annemarieruff.com. That's A-N-N-E. And so I will look forward to seeing you at the book fair.
Definitely. It was great talking to you, and thank you, everybody out there, for listening.
Thanks so much.
Left you on the debris at the Sunday morning market. You were starting through the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. Top of the stairs. At the depot, with the General Workers Union, and yet. change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working. Left you on the debris. Now we both know you got the money, and I wonder what.